Thank you all very much for coming. I want to thank AWATCH for inviting both of us to speak, because it's an issue about the accountability and transparency of aid that I feel doesn't get much coverage at all. I think there's good reasons for that, and I'll explain why I think that is. As was just said, I've written a book called Prophets of Doom, which has looked at the ways in which, in the last 30 years, the corporation has become more powerful than the state. I'm not the first person to argue this, of course, but I think what has happened, particularly since 9/11, even more so since September 11, is in the areas of resources and aid and war and detention centres, the corporation in Australia and elsewhere has superseded the state in ways that the state is very happy for this to happen, and the media often is colluded in that process. So I spent the last 3 years going to places like Afghanistan, Haiti, Papua New Guinea, around Australia and Pakistan, and looking at various different areas and corporations that are operating in those countries and those zones. The context of aid, I'll get to that in a minute, was in some ways one of the key ones, and that was particularly in Haiti and PNG. And I was also looking at, for example, in Australia, the role of private detention centre companies, Serco, G4S and others, names that you may have heard of, but names that don't get a lot of press. And this is, I think, a profound problem, because those who aren't aware, since the Howard years, and it's accelerated under the Labor years, under Gillard and Rudd, the detention centres are now outsourced to a handful of companies for massive contracts. And what you find, and this came out through various research, a whistleblower within Serco and other documents that I've discovered over the years, that the ways in which detention centre systems work is that the more people who are in detention in the last few years, as we all know, more and more boats have been coming, the less money is spent on care for those individuals. And there's a good reason for that, because of course that affects the bottom line. So why would a corporation, what's the incentive for that corporation to spend more money to assist refugees or the guards who work within that system? And that's what's become profoundly problematic. The effect of which is that Serco, which is the British multinational, now has contracts worth over $1.86 billion to manage, so to speak, refugees in this country on the mainland and Christmas Island. On Manus Island in PNG, it's run by G4S, which is also a British multinational, and there are a handful of other corporations that are also involved. And whenever Rudd or Abbott, wins in a few weeks, the system will not change. In fact, regardless of who wins, the system is fairly similar, as we know. The options are limited, and those corporations will be enriched even more. So when it comes to the question of aid, though, I wanted to start off by saying a brief story about Sean Penn. Everyone knows Sean Penn, he's a great actor, he's made countless films. What's less known about Sean Penn is he also sees himself as a humanitarian. And when the Haiti earthquake happened in January 2010, it was a devastating event, it was January the 10th, and in mid-morning, and the number of people killed is not clear, but anywhere between 50,000 and 300,000, the figures are widely disputed, but a lot of people. Haiti was a country that was broken many years ago. People who I spoke to there would say to me that they felt that Haiti was a country that has been independent for years but remains occupied by a range of forces. US aid, US officials, there's a UN military force there apparently to protect the people, although arguably it's doing more damage than good. A few years ago you may have heard cholera suddenly appeared in Haiti, which was brought by Nepalese UN troops, which has caused the death of thousands and thousands of people. The UN has done not just nothing, but actually hasn't accepted responsibility for what happened in the first place, inevitably causing distress and heartache and pain, etc., within the Haitian population. So the earthquake happens. A country which was already on its knees was broken even further. And a number of aid groups from day one went in there, mostly from the US and elsewhere, to help. And often that work was essential. The country was, particularly in Port-au-Prince, the capital, was in very, very bad shape. And when an earthquake or a natural disaster happens, and in many cases, immediate assistance is required. It's an obvious thing to say. However, Sean Penn, amongst others, had what he called a love affair with Haiti. He had been there many times over the years, and formed soon after the earthquake an NGO. And the aim of the NGO was to assist refugees, internal refugees, many people in the country then and even still to this day. There are roughly 100,000 Haitians who live in squalor, often in the middle of Port-au-Prince. I spent time with some of them there, who are almost being left abandoned by the state, by the UN, by the US, by aid groups. So Sean Penn forms an NGO. And the aim of it, as I said, is to help individuals, so he claims. And he runs, like him personally, but his organisation runs a refugee camp in Port-au-Prince. And what became very interesting, and the reason I mentioned Sean Penn, is that this, I think, goes to the heart of how humanitarianism has become almost the cool thing to do in the last years. And the problem with that, I think, has been that, and I give the example of this in the book, that the National Palace, which is this symbolic site in the centre of Port-au-Prince, it was a palace that's been used for decades for the centre of power. The earthquake happens and the palace collapses. It needed to be removed. It wasn't repairable. And I happened to be there at the time in August last year when the National Palace was being demolished and the debris was being removed. When I got there, I was speaking to people. I was there for 3 weeks, and I was speaking to various people who were telling me that the group that was removing the debris was Sean Penn's organisation. And I got access to the site, and I was seeing people in there who were doing it, and the workers themselves were black, Haitians. The ones who were leading the operation were white and American. And race does come into this when it comes to the question of how we actually apply aid and assistance. And one of the things that a lot of people said to me in Haiti and elsewhere, and particularly in that set of cases, we never felt independent anyway. And now we have a possibly, probably well-meaning, lovely white man from the state who's coming to help us, in inverted commas, manage this problem. So one of the things I saw in Haiti in countless examples, and I use Sean Penn as an unfortunate example, is that so many aid groups in that country actually are rarely, if ever, employing local people. This is a fundamental problem of, I think, so much aid I saw in Papua New Guinea as well, where there are certain levels where locals are employed or trained. This is true. But in so many cases, in Sean Penn's group, one amongst many, there's very little actually empowerment of local communities, the effect being that when these organisations leave, as they inevitably will, what's actually left behind? Not a lot. And I think one of the things that I try to talk about and I've researched in many countries is that we have this sense, I think, in the West, in many, particularly in the progressive left, for want of a better expression, community, is that NGOs are inherently good, doing their best, and just sort of trying to make a difference. And many NGOs are doing wonderful work. I'm sure many of you here work for NGOs doing wonderful work. My issue is not with NGOs per se. My issue is the almost inability for many in the so-called progressive side of politics to actually assess the effectiveness of what that aid is actually doing. And when you have a country like Haiti, which has had literally billions and billions of dollars of aid through NGOs, for-profit organisations and non-profit organisations, Haiti has arguably gone backwards since the earthquake was devastating, but the country's gone backwards. And WikiLeaks documents, and I should say as an aside, and I say this throughout the book, that for anyone who's interested in finding out actually how aid and development and power work, WikiLeaks documents that have been released in the last years are so essential, unbelievably essential, to the point where soon after the earthquake hits, there's a great cable, well, disturbing actually, but interesting cable, from the then US ambassador in Port-au-Prince, who's talking about the business opportunities for American businesses in Haiti. And the aid organisations that he's speaking to are looking to get in on that business, for-profit aid organisations. As we know, not all NGOs are not-profit. Many of them are, in fact, for-profit. And what these cables very clearly talk about is the ways in which the US government then, and still now, is facilitating US corporations to actually benefit from that aid money, which the US itself is doling out. And exactly the same thing is happening in PNG. The conflict and the situation is different. It's very different. But one of the things is I spent time in Bougainville on PNG, where most people will know there was a war there in the 80s and 90s over a Rio Tinto mine. And the mine itself had been operating for about 20-odd years, hugely polluting. And in the end, and I'm summarising a complex situation, the locals decided to resist and rise up against an incredibly destructive mine. There was a civil war of sorts that went for roughly 10 years. There were about 15,000 people killed. The PNG government, the Australian government, Rio Tinto worked together to collude against Bougainvillians who ended up winning that conflict, but at a very, very high price. And one of the things that's happening now, to fast forward from the late 90s to 2013, is there are now moves to reopen that mine. Rio Tinto is dying to get back in there. There's still gold and copper resources in that mine, worth, no one quite knows how much, but billions. You have a situation now, and documents have come out, where AusAid is directly funding and assisting advisors, so to speak, in Bougainville to give advice to the Bougainvillean government to make sure the mining contracts and legislation will make it amenable for Rio Tinto to return. And I think the issue with that is that there needs to be at least a discussion, let alone accountability, for the fact that Rio and many former staff members of Rio have spoken openly on the record about what they were involved with back in the day in the 80s and 90s during the war. It's not really even a secret. If you ask Rio point blank, they deny what their former employees are saying. But in reality, what Rio was doing, as I said, with the open collusion of the Australian government and the PNG government and indeed other private militias, was to try to suppress an insurgency, simply, and they lost. But Bougainville paid a massive price because the country is now in economic, or the province is in economic ruin. And the context for that is that Bougainville wants to be independent, as an independent state. And the peace treaty between Bougainville and PNG that was negotiated a number of years ago said there would be a referendum on independence by 2015 to 2020. And one of the things that many Bougainvillians said to me when I was there was that how do we find a revenue source that potentially is not the mine? In other words, a revenue source, if the mine reopens, is an easy revenue source. And there's no doubt that's potentially true. But there are alternatives, agriculture, tourism, which people talked about there. But when you have AusAid directly assisting not just a mining company, but also a local Bougainville government to facilitate the return of a mine with no actual accountability for A, what happened last time, B, cleaning up the environmental destruction. Some of you may have, I'm sure, been to mine sites around the world. I have too, but I've never seen a situation like in Bougainville where you visit a mine which at its height was the largest mine in the world. It was 7 kilometres from edge to edge. And when Rio Tinto left, they actually fled because they expected to return. So you have all these tractors and mining equipment that's been rusting for 25 years sitting there in the middle of this massive open-cut mine, which is still leaking oil 25 years after it was last touched by Rio Tinto, or Rio Tinto staff. And the talk of reopening this mine when the destruction environmentally, which is literally kilometre upon kilometre of sand and nothingness where there used to be forest, because the tailings from the mine has caused such profound destruction. No one's talking about cleaning that up. No one, really, seriously, is about talking about cleaning that up. So I guess I wanted to make this close and hand it over to Wendy to say, we can obviously have a conversation about this, that the examples of Haiti and PNG, and I haven't even talked about Afghanistan, which I spent time in last year as well, is that the issue to me of aid and corporatisation and militarisation of aid is not so much that aid in itself is the problem, it's the way it's administered and the way the corporations that are involved in administering it are rarely, if ever, held accountable for it. And when it comes to someone like Rio Tinto, who is sold as a developer and an assistant, and let's not forget, in Mongolia, another country where Rio Tinto has massive interests, Rio Tinto is operating in very huge mines. Mongolia is now the fastest growing economy in the world, which is mainly through a resource boom. And like in many countries, PNG, Haiti, Mongolia, the evidence is pretty much in that, with a handful of exceptions for a few individuals in a few small communities, locals and landowners rarely, if ever, benefit. And I think the narrative which we constantly hear in the press here is that development and progress and business is a good thing. And maybe in this room I'm preaching to the converted who say, no shit. But the problem is that the narrative that we routinely hear is the exact opposite of that. And when you have tax dollars from AusAid and us directly assisting individuals from the Australian university sector, including ANU, who are advising a Bougainville autonomous government how to facilitate the return of a polluting mine, those questions should be asked. That's received little press. And this is an aside, let me just finish on this. As many of you will be aware, a few years ago the law changed where you now cannot defame a corporation. Until recently you could defame a corporation. In other words, well, typically you could. If I wrote something like, as a journalist, Rio Tinto has committed war crimes in Bougainville, I would potentially face a legal problem. That has now changed to an extent, or has changed. However, what's been revealing to me in the last 6 months, when I've been writing about this, the number of editors at major news organisations who are still reluctant to actually publish direct, not just allegations, but charges against a company like Rio when the evidence is there. So to actually, we're not talking about individuals, we're talking about simply writing about Corporation X committed these crimes in the 80s. Here is the evidence, here are the photos, here's the footage. We'll not run it. Now, I'm not saying it's not some grand conspiracy, I'm simply saying there is profound reluctance in much of the mainstream press to take on, or seem to take on, a corporation, even though former Rio staff have said what they were doing. So let me leave it with that, and I mean, I've found ways to get around that, to sort of write something, and you know, journalists find ways to be creative in their expression. But it's been revealing to see even the more progressive media that I've been writing for are reluctant to take on Rio. So I'll leave it at that, and we can go to questions after Wendy. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony, and that was great to hear Anthony talking about his book, which I think it's fantastic to hear it actually is selling, because everybody who buys the book hopefully reads it. And I hope a lot of libraries buy it and people spread it around as well, because actually this is the first major contribution from an Australian journalist on this topic, which is a really important topic. I'd also like to thank AidWatch for inviting me tonight. I've actually known about AidWatch as an organisation since Lee Rhiannon and other people got it going many years ago. So it's terrific to see that it's kept going, and it's so important. AidWatch has been really the one organisation to highlight a lot of these things over the years, and I know it's hard to get publicity when you bring out reports and things, but I was pretty interested in this early on, and I've really only done, you know, one major series of stories on this, but it, just to begin on something Anthony ended on, this whole situation with the media is really quite interesting, I think. I began noticing, I guess around 1996 and after that, you know, I knew people actually who'd been working for AusAid who got offloaded. I'd known NGOs, I knew NGOs were beginning to lose out on work, I knew that companies were beginning to get the contracts. So I did have an interest in that, but I hadn't done any serious work on it. And then somewhere along the line, I became aware of a company called GRM International, which is still getting AusAid contracts now. And I was digging around, looking at GRM. I can't even remember why now. And I just noticed that it had a website that looked remarkably like a subsidiary of what was then Kerry Packer, became Jamie Packer's companies. Their major cattle properties up in the Northern Territory, and which were connected with a company called Ausrex, which was live meat exports company. So you had GRM International, actually, as it turned out, I found later when I actually went looking in Brisbane for the office of GRM International, it was actually shared with Ausrex. It was actually literally in the same office, about a quarter the size or less of this room. So the live export company, owned by the Packer family, was operating out of the same aid office, International Development Aid office in Brisbane. So I was pretty interested in that. And then I started looking. Now, I thought I'd mention here so that anyone could go home tonight and look up and see what's happening. I don't know how many of you know the government tenders database, www.tenders.gov.au. You can look up, go home and look up GRM International, you can look up Coffee, and you begin, which is another company I'm just going to mention in a minute, and you can see how the contracts that are coming through. Now, that doesn't mean you can find out much about them, but you can actually see the contracts that are coming through. Now, I don't want to suggest that I think all the people working for these companies aren't very, many of them are no doubt very good professionals, they've got a lot of skills, no doubt, you know, most of them are well-meaning individuals. But what is interesting, I think, is the lack of debate that has been about the advisability of handing over most of your aid budget to for-profit companies that are actually also active in live meat exports, major international agricultural activity, mining activity, when these are often public, not always, sometimes private companies, Kerry Packer, Jamie Packer's, it became, company was a private one, but the biggest one of all in Australia was at certainly the time when I last counted was Coffee, which is Coffee International, began as a mining company, began as an engineering company, became a sort of mixed company, one of these service companies, a mining company, an international development company, a geotechnical company, exploration company as well. So what concerns me about it is not so much, it's certainly not an individual level, I'm not sort of targeting or nor do I have any information about people, but simply to say it's remarkably unaccountable and there's remarkably little public discussion about it. So just going back to where I came into this, certainly AWATCH had done a couple of reports and I was aware of this GRM International firm and I thought, well, that's a pretty good story on the face of it. You know, as a journalist, here's, you know, the country's richest individual, Jamie Packer, big casino operator, also very big in the aid industry. You know, maybe the Australian public would like to know about that as a story. I'm not thinking about this even as a major expose. And so I, at the time, was doing stories for the Herald, so I'd be talking to the some of the key editors there, key investive people in there, and I'd say, look, you know, this is, I think we really should have a look at this. You know, I'd like to go deeper into this. They, for example, GRM International has had the entire contract for the civil part of the Ramsay operation in the Solomon Islands. They have hired the magistrates, they've, you know, well, basically done all the hiring, firing and running a large part of that operation, not the military part, obviously. So, you know, I thought, well, that'd be interesting too. Let's have a look at it, how it's all going. Now, the answer back always was, you're going to have an actual case of corruption. That is, you know, something that is really a scandal. Otherwise, it's just of no interest. Otherwise, you could say it's just how business is done. And that's how I think it partly becomes how business is done, because no one actually raises it as an issue. And of course, many issues get raised journalistically that are not scandals. But in a way, it goes very much, I think, to Anthony's point, that somehow it's not, you can't criticise Rio Tinto unless, you know, you've got a major bribery scandal on foot. So I'll just say that. Now, the one thing we did, I did this initially, I had students, you know, when I was still teaching investigative journalism at the university, I'd always do company searches. So I kept a bit of an eye on this and would do sample studies with people and then we'd have a look at the tenders database. So I was pretty aware of what was happening with these contracts. But then when I did the project for Crikey, what we decided to do, and this is something anyone could have done, it doesn't take any particular heavy skill, but we just downloaded, which you can do in tranches of 1,000, all of the contracts off the government tender database that had gone to AusAid, and then we put them into an Excel spreadsheet. Now, these days people, and this is now 4 or 5 years ago, these days people are doing much more spectacular things with data journalism. This is like really basic. So, but no one at that stage could tell you what proportion of contracts were going to NGOs, what proportion were going to corporations. So we just coded them. Just put in an extra column on Excel and just said NGO, corporation. And then, of course, we're also able to find the biggest ones and do profiles on them. And we produced some charts showing the pie graphs. And that was that project. Coffee was the biggest. And I think GRM International turned out to be the fourth biggest. There's also Cardno and GHD is another very big company in this field in Australia. Now, just to go back to GRM International, around the time when I was really interested in this, when Jamie Packer was losing a lot of money in the casino business when the GFC came, he nearly went bust there. So he had to offload a lot of things very quickly. And amongst the things that he offloaded in a management buyout was GRM International, all but one, I think, of the cattle properties and the live export meat company. So they were sort of, basically went back just to casinos and also got out of the US casino business. So when we're working on this, and I was quite closely in contact with AidWatch at that time, we found that those buyouts were facilitated by loans from what's called EFIC, the Export Finance, Investment Corporation, and in quite, you know, quick ways that you could find out very little about, but basically they didn't have the money to buy those companies from Jamie Packer. The government-owned corporation actually loaned the money for that to happen. Now, again, there's very little transparency around it, and I can't tell you much more about it at this stage than that because I've since moved on, as journalists unfortunately too often do, in looking at other stories. But just before I finish, I thought I'd just bring it up to date a little bit. And so here I am thinking, well, that's all a bit of a time, you know, a long time ago. What am I going to talk about here tonight that's a bit fresh? So I went back to the tender database, as any of you can do, and had a look at what was happening with coffee and with GRM International. And I find the language, maybe some of you are in the development business, you're used to the language, but I find the language very impenetrable when these projects are described. And so recently, Coffee International, which is, as I said, a mining and also exploration company, has got 53 million, this is over a period of years, of course, but 53 million, this is just one of many projects, and it's called the Subnational Strategy for PNG. So I think, what's the Subnational Strategy for PNG? And actually, you know, it is quite difficult to find out an awful lot more about this. Probably if I was working on this full time, I would get people at Coffee eventually who might be prepared to talk to me. But I'll just read you what it says. It insists PNG to improve the financial, legal and governance framework for decentralisation, as well as the organisational capacity of provisional, district and local level administrations to deliver services. It involves the co-location of both locally engaged and Australian OZAID offices in five provincial administrations. So that, in terms of what Anthony's talking about and what might be happening in Bougainville or any other part of PNG, here you've got a company. Now, it may well be that Coffee does not have a direct... They have in the past, I'm not sure what exactly the situation is at the moment in any of these particular projects, but if a company's Rio Tinto, that doesn't mean that a whole lot of other companies aren't involved with it. So they're absolutely embedded in government aid developments in the countries in which they potentially have interests. And there are evaluations of projects, of course, but one of the big evaluators is actually GRM International. They're likely to be, they have actually an evaluation arm, so they're likely to be in a position of evaluating the projects of, say, Cardno or Coffee. So you really have a web of companies that I think have overlapping interests. And unless there's a parliamentary committee or some other form of scrutiny, we don't find out much more about it. Now, Coffee is at the moment also involved in education in PNG. And then there's a project that I wanted to mention to you called, because I found this in terms of what Anthony's been looking at, very interesting. It's called the Strongman Govman, I think it's a project. And this is a very recent contract that's up on the database at the moment. I certainly didn't know anything about it. And this involves operations including security and also border control. Now, that immediately raises the question for me, is this project anything to do with what's happening on Manus Island, maybe what's happening on the border of West Papua? Is it to do with what's happening up in the Torres Strait? You know, I can't tell you, but it's something I think we should be able to find, we should know as citizens. And then I just thought I'd tell you that GRM International, after the management buyout, before that, the GRM International, if I showed you a chart of that company, it all ends up in the Bahamas tax haven, because that's where the Jamie Packer operations, that's where their family trusts have been for decades. And that's where the profits of the private arm of the Packer companies, which GRM International was, end up. But in the management buyout, it all shifted to Dubai. And essentially that company now is a very big company. Sweden, the Netherlands, the UK, they're getting lots of contracts in the UK, Africa, but they're operating really out of Dubai. That's their financial centre. So I just noticed that, you know, in their latest news, which you can see on their website, that they've got a new manager in the operating with 400 staff, it looks like, under him. And he's an ex-officer, Ken Marshall, ex-person who worked for AusAid. Now, I think it'd be fascinating to know how many ex-AusAid people are actually working in these private companies. And again, we can't say that's illegal or there's anything necessarily... certainly not corrupt about it, but if that's the way business operates, well, we certainly need to have more scrutiny and know how long the distance is in time between these jobs, what sort of safeguards there are against people sort of giving contracts to their mates because they were sitting next to them at AusAid last week and now they're over in London receiving contracts. You know, so that's just... You know, I'm not like Anthony, I haven't sort of gone into it nearly as deeply, but just as a journalist with basic skills, that's some of the sort of issues that have got raised for me. I think what's really good about what Anthony has done is that most of my work on this was all done, you know, from Sydney, all of it, other than the time I went to Brisbane, and I haven't been able to go to the places. That's what was missing from what I was doing, you know, really... Ideally, I would have gone to the Solomon Islands and really looked at what was happening with Ramsay there. And you know, that's why reporters should be out and about, not just stuck behind their desks in a university. So I think that's my comments. So I think we can probably, both of us, take questions now.
Yeah. Mm.